Hi, we're here in the podcast for
Creative Disturbance.
I'm Alex Garcito Pete. I'm an A-Tech master's student and executive editor of Future Echoist Review. With me is...
Hi, I'm Josh Brummett. I'm a master's student here at the University of Texas at Dallas. I'm also a writer dealing with environmental issues, and I'm looking at publishing a new environmental literary magazine.
And with us is our guest of the day, Jens Hauser.
Yeah, my name is Jens Hauser. I'm a curator interested in art and technology relationships, transgenre aesthetics, and I'm a researcher at Copenhagen University, both at the Faculty of Art and the Faculty of Health Science, and also affiliated with the Department of Art and Design at Michigan State University.
And for those of you who didn't read the title of the podcast, it's going to be Green Editing. Josh, do you want to get that conversation started?
Sure. Jens, you've worked a lot with the concept of greenness, greenness as it relates to art specifically. What can you tell us about the history of the idea of green art?
The main point of reflecting greenness in the light of art and cultural history is the affirmation that green is a most anthropocentric of all colors. It is, in fact, standing in for what we call nature, nature being a human construct as a concept, and that the largest spectrum of humankind, the visual spectrum, is in fact green, and it's allowing us to absorb these light waves, mainly that are waste for the plant world. So, in fact, we are absorbing the waste of the plants, and because of our very limited spectrum, we think that this greenness is natural. So it's very interesting to see that also the whole history of night vision devices, first computer screens, biomarkers, very often the color is green. So the greenness is in fact in the first place being conceived as something related to the green and growth. There's a link between the meaning of growth and green, something that is regrowing all the time. But at the other time, it has become a technical color. And precisely because probably we want to recreate the nature all the time, and maybe this is also why all the technical signaling colors have been first in place in green.
So do you see in the idea that human beings consider nature to be green, you see a sort of commentary on the divide between human beings and the natural world and the sort of inherent anthropocentrism to consider ourselves separate from nature?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see all the strategies, the cultural strategies, the discursive strategies, deep ecology, resulting in greenwashing, to hide greenhouse effects away, as a strategy to hypercompensate for the innate anthropogenic effects on our environment. So as the Volkswagen scandal brought out and other scandals, there is always this kind of tension to or this attempt to call things in which we would like to mask our anthropogenic effects away to green them. We are greening the media. We are, in fact, creating green biotechnology. We are creating green chemistry. All what we would like to hide away is becoming green.
And you see that concept as inherently anthropocentric?
I think it's probably our cultural drive to be finally aware of also a kind of bad consciousness. More and more artists, in fact, recently have been playing with this ambiguity of the green color. Let's take the art and science group Hehe, Heiko Hansen and Helen Evans. They have been creating this enormous green cloud in Helsinki as a kind of laser projection onto an artificially created cloud. So they are obsessed with man-made clouds, and they paint and laser paint this cloud's green. There is also a very interesting art project by even Sigmar Polke, who used Schweinfurt green, which was in fact a toxic poison to kill rats, but making paint especially of this green color. And what's interesting also is that green as a color standing in for nature in painting has always been the most toxic when it comes to the production of its particles and its pigments.
That's a very interesting point of how green isn't that all natural, especially from the side of the physics behind it. But speaking of how it affects the perception of audiences and even how the artists are supposed to use green as the intention, and you are also very interested in mediality and how to present or represent the work of art in the best way possible for the audiences, both as artist and as curator. In your experience, have lab-based biotech art pieces or media been more effective or had more of an impact with the audience than natural set pieces of bio art?
Well, the illusion of something natural going on is very often because you have growth, and growth again is linked to green. So yes, we have artworks, for example, that hide their innate technological intervention away. Let's take the example of Jun Takita's famous transgenic moss sculpture, in which he has been modeling the very contours of his own brain with transgenic moss that is then activated with a luciferin solution so that it glows in the dark, creating a brain that is in fact covered by moss. So to also address the paradox that an organism normally that photosynthesizes, that means to consume light, actually is giving light away. That's something in evolution he would never do. So here the technological aspect is totally hidden by the greenness of what seems to be natural. So I think there are interesting examples of how these artworks point to the interventions of humankind at large when it comes to what we can call with Nicole Carafillis as a biofact. That means a living system that is the equivalent of an artifact, so a kind of man-made artifact, but in which the technical intervention in the very beginning is hidden away so that we cannot perceive it anymore.
And how much do you think that affects the artistic quality of a work of art, if the technicality is brought to the foreground against to being in the background?
I think it's important to think in terms of biotechnological revolution, not only about possible products, about possible health-related innovations, about agriculture-related products, but really to have in mind what it actually is taking place, and that you have a lot of waste going on, that it's not a total control of the organism. But at the same time, it asks the questions whether the scaling of what may be happening at the laboratory scale, what is happening when this microscopic scale is confronted with the ecological scale of the outside world. So I think that's really important that these issues are being discussed in order to democratize not only the technologies and the access that everybody should have to technologies that are shaping our future, but that we really create a kind of philosophically inspired debate on which technologies do we want and which we don't want, and that artists play a very, very central role in this game.
I thought it was very interesting hearing that, you know, green paint can occasionally be toxic. And throughout the history of art, there's been some tension between art and the environment itself. But it seems to be an issue that will come to the forefront in bio art, especially like the pigeon d'or, the golden pigeon, which, you know, would be a pigeon that contains biologically and genetically altered bacteria in its gut that makes it excrete soap. So in an artwork like this, you really begin to see extreme environmental impacts and occasionally you know, the possibility for very unforeseen environmental impacts. So to what degree now would a bio artist have to take into account what's actually going to take place in the world if they're planning on creating living artwork?
Well, this project, Pigeon d'Or, initiated by Tour von Baalen, consists of the creation and the writing of a biobrick that enables bacteria that naturally occur in the gut of pigeons to express enzymes that are breaking down fat. And it also affects the degree, the pAD degree that is in the gut of the pigeons. It has been tested how much time such bacteria would need to replace the microbiome of a normal pigeon, but it has not been set free. So there was no release of genetically altered organism into the environment. However, it asks the question whether animals commonly known as flying rats that we are able to poison without any remorse become also the target and the object of consideration through ethics and care whenever, in fact, they may be useful to clean our cars. So, in fact, this project is departing from the micro scale of the creation and the writing of a biobrick, asking aspects of law, aspects of release of genetically manipulated organisms, but it also points to a very contemporary discipline that is that of metagenomics. Not to consider only that, well, the bacteria are not transgenic, the pigeon is not, but they live in an organism, and the organism, as we know, the human cells are outnumbered by 10 by our microbial friends in our bodies, so the same for animals. So can we say that this animal then is not transgenic if 90% of its cells are actually transgenic? So it asks questions about the ecology of our bodies and our bodies as ecologies, not to be limited and encapsulated by a membrane, but actually that these individual organisms are in fact also kind of ecologies that correspond. And this is also an epistemological question to be asked, in how far we can really still think of mesoscopic organisms as individuals.
Okay, well, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Johns. And until next time.